from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is Robert Siegel, former host of NPR's All Things Considered. Great Podversations features nationally recognized writers and journalists in candid conversation about books and ideas. Great Podversations is produced by the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. It's an honor for me to continue my long relationship with this series, which televises its forums on PBS affiliates as Great Conversations. Today, investigative journalist, author Barton Gellman speaks with Washington Post national security reporter Ellen Nakashima about Mr. Gellman's bestseller, Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State. Barton Gellman is a Pulitzer Prize and Emmy Award-winning journalist. Since 2013, he has been a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. During 21 years at the Washington Post, he served tours as legal, military, diplomatic, and foreign correspondent. He has taught courses at Princeton on nonfiction writing, investigative reporting, and national security secrecy. His best-selling Angler, The Cheney Vice Presidency, won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a New York Times Best Book of 2008. Ellen Nakashima is a national security reporter for The Washington Post, who writes about cyber, intelligence, and related issues. In 2018, she and her colleagues won a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of Russia's efforts to influence the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. In 2014, she was part of a team that was awarded a Pulitzer for reporting on the hidden scope of National Security Agency surveillance and its policy implications. Since joining the Post in 1995, she also has served as a Southeast Asia correspondent and reported on the White House and Virginia politics. We hope that you enjoy this great podversation with Barton Gellman and Ellen Nakashima.
It's great to be doing this conversation with you, Bart. You and I have known each other for over 20 years, and you're one of the most gifted national security journalists in the business. I've learned a lot from you. So let's get started. On one level, your book is the remarkable tale of a contractor for the largest, most powerful electronic surveillance agency in the world, who turned that agency upside down with his leaks to you and two other journalists. Those leaks led to what you termed a national reckoning on surveillance. His name, Edward Snowden, has become shorthand for that reckoning, which we can talk more about later. But on a more fundamental level, it's an exploration of not the legality, but the morality of what the agency is doing today, given remarkable advances in technology. So why don't you start by talking about how you came to write Dark Mirror? If I recall, this was not the book you started out to write.
No, it really wasn't. You recall correctly. I had in mind that I was going to write this encyclopedic, broad, world-spanning tome on surveillance, that it was going to be both public sector and private sector. It was going to be historical and contemporary. It was, you know, like the photographers say, you know, a wide-angle close-up. It was a crazy idea, and I quickly realized it was going to have to be pared down. And I also realized that I was going to have to put myself into the book to tell the narrative I wanted to tell. And that was uncomfortable because we're trained to keep out of the story.
Indeed. Well, you know, the tale of how you came to this is so interesting too, because Edward Snowden did not reach out to you, first of all, right? He reached out to another journalist, a documentary maker named Laura Poitras. So how did you come to this story, to be in touch with Snowden? In fact, I think he actually went by an alias, right? At first, he didn't say, "I'm Edward Snowden." I think it was Verax or something.
No, he didn't. Edward Snowden did not pick me on purpose. He acquiesced in my participation in this story after time went by. It started off like this. He was looking for a ferocious advocate of his position. He was looking for someone who would agree with him that there was something scandalous about the way U.S. surveillance was being conducted, and who was not afraid to take on the government in a conflictual sort of way. And he wanted Glenn Greenwald. And Glenn had been a blogger. He was at the time writing for The Guardian. And Snowden used a nom de guerre as Cincinnatus and wrote a pseudonymous email to Glenn Greenwald and said, I have a really big story for you. It has to do with U.S. intelligence. I need to correspond with you in an encrypted way. So would you please teach yourself to use PGP, pretty good privacy encryption, and then we'll talk. And Greenwald looked at that, and he's not a technical guy, and he said, yeah, whatever, and he ignored it. Snowden came back to Greenwald, and he said, oh, I have a really important story. You really should do this. Here, I've made you a video how to do encryption. And Snowden had disguised his voice using some sort of, you know, computer transcriber, had literally made it, this is how you do it, click here, click here, click here, and now our email is encrypted. And he put it up on Vimeo, and he sent a link to Greenwald, and Greenwald ignored it. So at this point, Snowden turned to his second choice, who was Laura Poitras, a documentary filmmaker. And I think you know some of Laura's work. One of the things she had become known for was being a target of surveillance, that every time she crossed a U.S. border, she got pulled aside for secondary screening. They searched all of her belongings by hand. They made copies of her electronic data. And this had been written about. And Snowden had read it. And he said, well, you would understand what it's like to be the subject of interest of the surveillance state. So let's talk. A few days later, Laura flew from Germany, where she was living, to New York and said, can you and I get together, Bart? I've got something I want to ask you about. And she sent me that note encrypted, which was not normal for us. I had known her a little bit at NYU. And she wanted to meet in a cafe. And you must have had nervous sources before, Ellen, where someone, you know, you walk into a cafe and they look around and say, no, this isn't it. Not private enough. And we switched places three times. And finally, she told me, I'm getting these anonymous emails from someone who calls himself Virax, which I had to look up. It's Latin for truth teller. And he claims to be an intelligence insider. And have you ever heard of this term or that term or the other term? And we started to take apart the question of, is this guy for real? For some reason, we assumed it was a guy. I don't know why.
Laura flew from Germany to New York to meet with you because she wanted you to help her out with the story or with this source.
She knew that I had put some time and effort into covering secret surveillance. I'd written a book about Dick Cheney called Angler, and two chapters of it were about the secret and illegal surveillance program that Cheney had created after 9/11. And so I knew something about the subject, and Laura felt like, as a filmmaker, she could tell part of this story, but part of the story was going to require the print medium and the kind of depth and space that that would provide.
So eventually you and she determined that maybe there was something to this strange Virax, and you eventually started to communicate with him. But in what way did you actually communicate with him?
Well, so we had to get over that hurdle first. I mean, how many times, Ellen, have you, as someone who covers national security, received a hot tip from someone, maybe thousands of words, explaining that they have the scandal of the century, and or possibly that the CIA has planted a transmitter in their teeth, or, you know, people with sad mental health conditions. So the first thing we had to figure out was, is this person Virax for real? Is it at all likely that this person knows anything, is in a position to know anything, is going to be reliable? And so I started a whole long process of cross-examining him to try to get a sense of the veracity of the material he was going to give me. And he was cross-examining me because Laura had introduced us and he had agreed to go along with it. He was cross-examining me, though, knowing that I was a member of the mainstream media, that my career had been largely at the Washington Post. Could he rely on me to antagonize the government? If the story were true and the government didn't want it published, would the Washington Post go forward? And he was very much afraid that we would cave in somehow.
How did you deal with that? I mean, I think you write that he wanted you to be an advocate, to put out the story he wanted to tell. And you said you just wanted to be a goddamn journalist.
Yeah, that came a little bit later at a very tense moment, which we can talk about. But I always made it clear I was not going to be his advocate, but at the same time, I made it clear I was very much interested in overreach by the intelligence community, that those kinds of stories were interesting to me, that I had done them before, that I had done it in the Cheney book, that I had done it in covering, for example, the FBI's use of national security letters in a long story in the Washington Post, and so on. I convinced him that I really cared about the story and that I was not going to back down from it, whatever I found. I said, I'm not going to be your advocate. I'm not going to take a strong position in a debate about what should be done, but I'm going to lay out the facts in a way that enables a debate we haven't had before.
So you eventually convinced him, and he eventually agreed to share data with you, information, documents that were very highly classified. And I remember you talking about how, I mean, it just blew your mind, the amount of data he gave you, and even just trying to parse all of it. I mean, there were files within files within files, and I think your eyes were crossing. How did you navigate all of that, Bart? And you're doing this at the time as a, you were working for Time Magazine, if I recall, not for the Washington Post.
Yeah, I had left the Washington Post in 2010, and we're talking now about 2013. I was a contributing editor at Time Magazine, and when the story first came to me, I considered whether I should do it for Time. And I tell the narrative in my book of my attempt to work inside Time Magazine, sort of chain of command, and its publisher were afraid of the story and didn't want to be dealing with a story that would disclose classified information. And I realized I just couldn't stay there. And I was quite relieved at the idea of going back to my old home at the Washington Post. But all this time, I had been under the impression, and so had Laura, that we were dealing with one document, that Ed Snowden, who still hadn't named himself, but that VRAX was going to tell us why it was important. And then he was going to pass along an actual classified document that documented the program he was talking about. And that is a very rare thing. You've done dozens of stories in your life, Ellen, that touched on classified material. That happens all. You can't do your job as a national security reporter without crossing into something that has a stamp on it. But as I know you and I have discussed before, it is exceedingly rare to actually be given possession of a top secret or above top secret document in its entirety, especially about something contemporary. I had never seen anything that was stamped TSSCI before, secure compartmented information, and that had code words on it. I'd simply never seen a document like that before. I know very few, if any, news reporters who had. And what happened was that on one day from VRAX, we got one document, and the next day we got 50,000. How am I possibly supposed to authenticate these documents and verify the accuracy of their contents? And that's two different things, right? I mean, in 1948, it was an authentic Chicago headline that Dewey defeats Truman. But in fact, it was the other guy who took the oath of office. And so I needed to know both whether this was an authentic document and whether what it said was accurate. And I'd understand it. It was filled with jargon and alphabet soup and code words and highly technical information. So it was a reporting challenge to do even one of these stories. To try to imagine how I was going to do a whole bunch of them was stressful and overwhelming.
There was a lot of stress in this entire saga. I mean, in fact, in the early days, I think you assumed he was working with you and Laura, and you and he, Laura, exclusively. But it turns out he was also, he, I guess at some point, had also contacted Glenn Greenwald. And that made for a strange competition, I guess, in the early days. Did he actually tell you that he had reached out to Greenwald? And how did you find out?
I knew all along that he had wanted to reach Greenwald, and Laura, who was a friend of Greenwald's, wanted to help facilitate that. And she eventually used an intermediary to get Glenn trained up on how to use the encryption and anonymity software. Because, I mean, Snowden, at the time we were in communication early on, he was still working for the NSA. He was in the belly of the beast. And the beast is the kind of beast that the job of which is to intercept national security communications. And he was talking to reporters about those secrets and taking great personal risk In doing so, he could only talk over encrypted and anonymous channels. It required a certain amount of willingness to learn to talk to him that way. Laura eventually got Glenn using this material, but it was an exclusive relationship with Snowden. It was me and Laura and Snowden and just the three of us until Snowden asked me to do something that I couldn't say yes to.
What was that?
He wanted my first story not only to include the complete document he had given me about a program called Prism that was the NSA's way of getting information from large internet companies, so the content of people's Google and Yahoo and Facebook accounts and so on. He not only wanted me to publish the document itself, he wanted me to publish something called a cryptographic signature that he had made on that document. And you could imagine this, you could analogize it to one of those old-fashioned stamps that, you know, the king or the duke would take the metal ring and make an imprint on a puddle of wax and seal the envelope that way. And Snowden wanted to leave a digital imprint on this that he could use to prove that he was our source. Now, normally when you have an anonymous source, you're very concerned with keeping that person anonymous and not disclosing the person's identity. Snowden not only wanted to make himself known as the source, but he wanted to be able to prove it. He wanted to be able to go in to a foreign embassy and say, I am the person who gave the Washington Post this story. I can prove it. Here's my digital signature. And he wanted to do that so that he could request asylum from the United States. And what he wanted me to do was to help him get asylum by publishing a signature that he could use as a bona fide with a foreign government. And I felt that was not the role of a journalist and not something that I could say yes to. And when I refused, that's when he said, I'm not going to keep this, he said, unilateral, exclusive anymore. And that's the week that he finally made contact with Greenwald.
I see. And in that week, though, you were racing, you worked on that story, Prism, and you were trying to get it done and get it out, right?
Right. Well, I had the document and he said, well, what else could you need? That's it. You've got the document, write the story. And it really wasn't that simple. First of all, it was really hard to understand the document. Second of all, it had some things in it that I knew as soon as I saw them, I was not going to publish because they were appropriately very secret. That is to say, there were things in there that disclosed that the US government was listening in on things that a major U.S. adversary thought we couldn't hear and had learned some startling things by doing so. And anybody who would look at this would recognize that entity as a foreign adversary that U.S. government should appropriately be concerned about. And that if we made public that, well, when they talk on this channel, the U.S. government is listening, that operation would have ended right away, that it would have been the loss of the whole program. And I had no interest in publishing stories like that. So I had a document that was hard to understand, that included sensitive details, and that it was going to be difficult to verify. I had to find people who knew what they were talking about, who could say, yes, this is valid. Yes, this program really exists, because I can't just take a piece of paper that someone emailed me and say that that's the basis for a story. So I was working hard on the story, but it wasn't something I could do on a quick turnaround.
And then as I recall, because I recall this vividly, it was maybe summer night, early June. I was out on the patio having a glass of wine, before dinner, I think. And all of a sudden, an email pops on my phone and I see it. And it's a story in The Guardian. NSA has been collecting millions of Americans' phone records, you know, from phone companies. And I read and I go, oh my God, what is this? I raced upstairs to my office and I made a phone call to a source, a couple of sources who said, because what was interesting about the story is that it reproduced an actual document, a court order to Verizon that showed that the NSA had served an order on this company for all of the phone records kept by Verizon on a daily basis.
Right. And that was a classified court order.
It was a classified court order from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And I explained it to my source. He said, what's the name of the judge? I read the judge's name and what's the statute? And he says, that sounds legitimate. I mean, this is a source who had actually worked on the program. So you know what he's talking about. And I realized immediately, this was the program that a number of us national security journalists had been we suspected something like that was going on, but we didn't really have the proof until now. And I raced and wrote the story. It broke. We put it up. We matched The Guardian. And then I think I ran into you the next morning or something in the back entrance of the Post. And you were in a real hurry, but you were saying, there's a big story coming, more to come, something cryptic like that. And then, in fact, was it the following day after Glenn Greenwald broke that story that you broke the Prism story?
It was the following day. People who were seeing me, I'd been basically in hiding. I recall I had left the employee of the Washington Post, and I had come back secretly to work on these stories after
sneaking up the back entrance of the Post, right, from the side.
I was. So it was kind of like, what are you doing here? Didn't you leave 3 years ago? And I didn't really want to say too much about what I was doing here because it was a secret scoop. But yeah, I said more to come. And that next day is the day that I broke the Prism story. And then it was off to the races. And when I came to the Washington Post, I talked to the editor, Marty Baron, and said, I'm going to need help with this. You've got a team of really impressive people working there. We're going to have to be careful and discreet. And I'm not going to be able to give complete access to this archive to anybody because it's filled with things that also should not be published. And so I don't feel that I should spread them around. But I'd like to be able to select out documents and share them with colleagues like Alan Nakashima and say, you know, help me figure out what this means and write a story about it.
Tell us why and how you came to the Washington Post with these documents to work on these stories. You had left 3 years earlier.
I had left. I was working somewhere else. The time simply couldn't handle a story of this magnitude and this sensitivity. I gave some thought to going to the New York Times. And I was living in New York City. So it was now my hometown paper. They had lots of resources. And I just decided it was asking too much, that the level of trust required was sort of off the charts. They would have to trust me and I'd have to trust them. And I just didn't know them. I didn't know them well. I didn't know Marty Baron either. He was still new as editor of the Washington Post. I had never worked for him. I had friends who spoke highly of him. But I had a lot of requests. Because this material was so sensitive, I said before, I had never seen one top secret SCI document before, and I now had tens of thousands of them. That was no reporter had ever had a cache of material that extensive and that sensitive. And I said, we're going to have to take extra care with this. We can't be putting the whole thing out on the web, and we can't allow it to be stolen from us either. And I asked him for a lot. I asked him for a secret room at the Washington Post where there would be a heavy safe and we would take computers and we would strip them of all their communications gear so they couldn't touch any kind of network. And we would encrypt the material on the hard drive and we would keep the encryption key on a separate physical key. And that would never be in the same room as the computers with the safe. And the list went on and on. And I said that when I communicate with someone like Alan Nakashima, it's got to be encrypted. We can't use normal messaging systems to talk about stuff this confidential.
No, you had put together a team of, 5-10 reporters. And look, Bart, I've known you for years. You are always the most operational, security-minded reporter I've ever known, but what you instructed us to do made even that look like Mickey Mouse. I mean, it's Gelman-esque. I know you put together a pamphlet of, 30 pages, single-spaced of instructions of what we had to do to keep all of these documents secure and military-grade encrypted, iron key, USB drive we used and could not take anything out of the room. It was amazing what you had us do.
So, I mean, be honest, people thought I was a little nuts. I mean, it was over the top. And I mean, I was stressed out and thinking that I had to do everything I possibly could do to keep this stuff secure. But I know that people talked about it behind my back.
Yeah, no, but we understood the significance of this and the gravity. And I also want to ask you to talk a little bit about how you dealt with the intelligence community, with the National Security Agency, the NSA, the Office of Director of National Intelligence, ODNI. Here you were in possession of top secret SCI documents. You wanted to and needed to talk to them, but they couldn't talk to you on encrypted channels. So how did you navigate that?
That's so interesting because it was so counterintuitive. I mean, the very first story about Prism, I got in touch with someone in the White House and said, I have a highly sensitive story that you're going to want to know about and want to talk to me about. How would you like to do that? I was assuming that they wouldn't want to use ordinary email or an ordinary telephone call to talk about stuff that I was strongly implying was highly classified. Next thing I know, I get a call from Bob Litt, who was the chief counsel to the director of national intelligence. And I said, why don't you go and get a copy of a document with this title and this author and this date on it with the following stamps on it, get it from the NSA, and then tell me how you'd like to talk about it because I'm holding it in my hands. And he called back and there were a whole bunch of people on a conference call who did not identify themselves, who were part of the call. And he said, all right, well, let's talk about it. And I said, here? I mean, right on the regular phone? And he said, yeah, because they were in a bureaucratic bind. They're not allowed to talk to me about classified material at all. I'm not allowed to have access to the encrypted government systems that they use to talk safely about this stuff because I don't have a clearance. And so they didn't know what to
do. Couldn't you meet with them in person?
At times I could and did, but sometimes we were in different cities and sometimes they just couldn't do it. That day, Bob Litt had to go down with the director of national intelligence for an emergency briefing on the Hill because they were already dealing with the first story about the phone records. And so the short answer is, we always did this entirely by ordinary email and telephone calls and some in-person things. There were times when they asked me to send them things by email and I simply refused. So I was the hard ass. And there was an amazing scene where we made a printout of some materials that I wanted to ask them about that I was not willing to send on ordinary email. And they sent someone out from Fort Meade to drive and pick it up. And our colleague Julie Tate was the one who was handing off the material. And she made him show ID to prove that he was from the government before she handed over the material. And he was like, you're asking me for ID? I'm the one who's got an authority to possess this material. You don't. But she did. She stuck to her guns. She got his ID. But that's how we did the interchange.
The other amazing aspect of this enterprise, this endeavor, was that, you know, generally at the Post, we take care to weigh the sort of harm to national security against the public interest. And especially with talking about documents like and stories like these, we do that balancing. And I think most people, even including some in the intelligence community, don't understand that or realize the extent to which the Post engaged in such due diligence with the Snowden documents. Can you talk a little bit about that? Pull back the curtain?
We don't automatically publish everything we know. I already mentioned that there were things even in the very first document that I never considered publishing. So in fact, when I had the conversation with Bob Litt, I said to him, first of all, to get some things out of the way that I think will be on your mind, everything between pages 14 and 24, you know, we have no interest in publishing. He said, well, we're glad to hear that. And on the other hand, there were things in the document that he didn't want us to publish that we did publish. And the main example of that is the NSA was getting the content of more than 100,000 accounts from Google and Facebook and Yahoo and so on. And there were 9 companies altogether. And the NSA did not want us to name the companies. And I said, why do you not want us to name the companies? And Bob Litt said to me, if you name the companies, they may be reluctant to cooperate anymore in this program. And I said, look, this is above my pay grade. You're going to have to bring this up to my boss if you want. But as far as I'm concerned, if the harm that you're describing consists of the American people not liking something they read in the Washington Post and then companies stopping doing it, that's not a reason not to publish. That's a reason to publish. The idea is to let the people know what their government is doing and make their voices heard. So we did publish the names of those companies, but we did not publish any of the specific intelligence targets that the NSA was directing its efforts against. That's a fairly typical thing that happens, that the government tries to keep secrets, we try to find them out, and then we tend to, it's not actually a negotiation, because the ultimate decision about what we publish, if we already know it, is ours. But we really want to know what harm they're saying would come from this. And there are lots of times when something is not obviously harmful when you just look at it on a page and they can explain to you, well, yeah, it is, here's why. And that's persuasive sometimes.
Yes, Amina, but I remember that caused some heartburn within the intelligence community because they couldn't understand why it was even up to us in the first place, why they couldn't just take back all the documents or have the government come and, you know, seize them. Who are we, right, to decide what's in the public interest?
Totally understandable. I mean, who the hell is Bart Gellman or who's the Washington Post to decide what classified information gets made public? And I have an answer to that. It's not that journalists should be the final arbiters of what is and isn't classified. The government keeps billions and billions of secrets, and most of them stay secret. When a news organization finds out something, it's usually because it's controversial and causing a fight inside the government, is violating a pledge the government made, or is contradicted by the government's public statements or something like that. That's usually how it is we come into possession of something like this. In those cases, you have a direct conflict of two major principles. I mean, one is the need for self-defense, and national security secrets sometimes are important for security, sometimes, not always. And the other is the need for self-government. We're supposed to be the sovereign, the people. We have to hold the people with power to account for what they're doing. And we can't accept a country in which the president, for example, could, for any given arbitrary piece of information, say, this is a secret, the people must never find out about this. You can't give the president full discretion on that, because then you can't hold him accountable. It's too powerful a weapon to hide what you're doing from the people who are voting. And so I'm not qualified to decide what's harmful to the national defense. The president is not qualified to decide what we need to know in order to hold him accountable. And so you have a competition and ultimately a kind of cooperation at the boundary.
And if you were being pulled from one side by the intelligence community, you were pulled from the other by Edward Snowden himself, right? I mean, I think you hinted earlier that he wanted you to become, to be an advocate. I mean, he is a complex person, often reduced to a stereotype of a whistleblower or a villain, and he's actually neither. How do you view him, and how did you navigate the pressure from him to put out more of it? I mean, I'm sure maybe he would have wanted you to print everything in the document. How did you address that challenge?
Well, surprisingly, Snowden was not pushing for more and more disclosure. I mean, he had complete control. I mean, this is a guy who certainly knows how to work the internet. I mean, if he had wanted to disclose all those documents, he would have put them up on a hard-to-censor website and mirrored them around the world on a bunch of different servers, and they would have been made public. He wanted the journalists to make our own judgments about what was newsworthy and what was not. And so he very, very seldom pushed me. He did occasionally, but mostly he left it up to me what I should write about. And you ask what he's like. Everybody's met people who are true believers, who are absolutely convinced of their own worldview, who have thought it through and are sort of completely bullheaded about it. They know exactly what they think. They have a very clear, even a black and white sense of right and wrong. And that's Snowden. I mean, he's more a zealot than anything else. He believed that what he was seeing was wrong. He believed it was a threat to democracy. He believed that none of the institutions that were supposed to conduct oversight over the NSA were willing and able, in fact, to conduct that oversight. That, for example, the congressional committees had been captured by the agencies they were overseeing and actually did not know a lot of what was going on.
Did you agree with him? Did you feel that was right?
I think he's right that at a certain level, there was an absence of accountability internally. The NSA, on the one hand, has an enormously rich and complex system of rules and regulations that govern it. And the people who work there truly do their best to follow the regulations. And they're really complicated. They're really hard to explain, even for someone who spent years studying them. Understanding what the rules are for minimization, which is the procedure according to which the agency takes information that is about Americans and strips it of identifying data, sometimes, usually, but not always, understanding those rules alone is a life's work. And so people don't always succeed in following the rules, but I think they really do try. But Congress, for example, doesn't understand these immensely complex systems. The FISA court doesn't understand these immensely complex systems. And that becomes clear when you read some of the decisions that were made public post-Snowden, that the judges would discover years after making a ruling that they had fundamentally misunderstood the way a system actually worked upon which the ruling was based. They don't have technical advisors. And also, the FISA court doesn't have jurisdiction over most of what the NSA does. Most of what the NSA does takes place overseas and is not aimed at Americans, and therefore is out of the jurisdiction of the FISA court and out of the usual notice of the intelligence committees. So Snowden was right that the only way to really have a public debate was to let the public in on what was happening.
What was it that prompted you to say that, you know, he wanted you to put out the story he wanted to tell, and you said you wanted to just to be a goddamn journalist? What prompted that?
That happened at the time when, before the first story ran, when he first explained that he needed me and Laura to publish his cryptographic signature on a document, that he needed us to help him prove that he was our source so that he could go to foreign government embassies or consulates and say, I'm the source of this story. I am therefore a political dissident. I am under political persecution by the United States for my humanitarian work, and you need to give me asylum. He wanted us to help him. And I was saying that that would be crossing a line that we couldn't cross either legally or morally. And I just want to be a goddamn journalist. You know, I want to write the story. I don't want to be faced with this problem. But we had to come up with a joint answer to Snowden, and we told him no.
Perhaps the most significant and underappreciated story was one you broke with Ashkan Soltani, an independent researcher and technologist who you brought onto the team to help us understand the technical aspects of the documents. The story you and Ashkan wrote explained how the NSA and its British partner, the GCHQ, were tapping into the links that connected the overseas data centers for Google and Yahoo. You alluded to the fact that a lot of this takes place outside the jurisdiction of domestic surveillance laws under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. This program was not overseen by the domestic law or that court. Tell us a little bit about that.
There's a British expert named Graham Cluley who has an expression I like. He says the cloud is just another word for somebody else's computer. So what is Google? When you put your stuff in the cloud, what is Google? It is a global system of enormous data centers. Each covers, you know, multiple city blocks, has its own electrical substations and enormous warehouses full of refrigerated rooms with banks of computers. And that's the cloud. The Google cloud consists of data centers all over the world with this vast computing power that holds copies of all this information. And the NSA had the power under the FISA law to go to Google and say, give me this information about Ellen Nakashima, because we're very interested in what she's been up to. And it did that. But it also used its spy tools to hack into Google and Yahoo, into their cloud infrastructure, into these gigantic data centers overseas. Specifically, it hacked into the private fiber optic cables that connected one data center to another. And in doing so, it helped itself to access to hundreds of millions of accounts. It had a list of the ones that were interesting to it. It filtered and sifted the data as it liked, but it had access to actually several billion accounts by doing this. And those accounts included hundreds of millions of American accounts. And so even though this operation took place overseas, and presumably I'm willing to grant the likelihood that the targets of the surveillance were ultimately going to be foreign targets, the privacy of millions of Americans was impacted. And Google and Yahoo and Microsoft and Facebook and the other large internet companies more shocked and angry about this story than any other story in the whole sequence of Snowden revelations. The idea that they were being treated as adversaries and hacked into by their own national intelligence agency infuriated them. And they then spent tens of millions of dollars of their own company money in a deliberate effort to thwart surveillance by their own government against their systems. So it became a kind of a point counterpoint.
Absolutely. Now, I remember one of my sources who worked for Google calling me as soon as that story broke And he was livid, and because he had no idea that this was going on. And so that was just beyond the pale for him. So we're running a little low on time, and I wanted to get to a couple more questions, including how you write toward the end of the book, Bart, in the early 21st century, the NSA had amassed a degree of latent power that Snowden believed to be an inherent threat. The machinery of electronic surveillance, and in particular of bulk collection, spanned so broad a reach that its mere potential for misuse was cause for alarm. He told you the only things that restrict the surveillance state are policy. Do you agree with him? And what is he suggesting the government do? Dismantle the technology?
I do agree with him, and I put it to James Clapper after he left office as the Director of National Intelligence and after a 50-year career in U.S. intelligence. And he was surprisingly sympathetic to the dimensions of this problem, which is, okay, the United States is not East Germany. It is not using its surveillance powers in an effort to control the political views of its populace. It is not using its intelligence agencies for political oppression. Happy to grant that. But it has built a machine that with just a few levers switched from here to there is capable of intercepting everything that everyone says all the time and storing it and correlating it and putting together a gigantic data-rich sort of social network diagram of all Americans and how they interact with each other and learning very private things about us. All those machines are already built. And Snowden talked about the problem as being one of turnkey tyranny. All you'd have to do is turn a key, change a few lines of policy or a few lines of computer code, and suddenly the machine is doing things that no one would want it to do. And Jim Clapper admitted that that is basically true. He said the problem is you can't unlearn how to build this machine.
Right. You can't dismantle the technology, right?
Even if you dismantle it, he said, somebody could just build it again. But it needs the strongest kind of safeguards, I think, in order to avert temptation. Because the thing about the thin edge of the wedge is it just keeps on pushing and keeps on pushing. And something that you do just one time in one specific set of circumstances, you say, well, that was pretty handy. Let's do it again. And there's a slippery slope, according to which intelligence powers tend to grow. And if the only people who know about them are on the secret side of the fence, and in the classified world and participating in the activities, then you don't get the kind of accountability that draws a real boundary.
So that suggests that the full reckoning on surveillance that Snowden jump-started, in fact, his revelations did lead to, you know, reforms, new laws, the dismantling of bulk collection or just sort of narrowing of it. But we still haven't, I think, had that full reckoning on surveillance that you talked about. Would you agree? And if so, what would that look like? What would that reckoning look like to you?
The NSA did a pretty good job of confining the public debate to two programs. One was the collection of telephone records, the listing of who called who and when, and the other being the PRISM program of obtaining content of internet communications from the big internet companies. All the other activities that Snowden disclosed, they said, were appropriate, lawful, normal foreign intelligence activities that had no effect on Americans. Now, as I've just explained, when it comes to the Google Cloud, for example, I strongly disagree. There is a big effect on Americans when you break into the Google's main infrastructure of information overseas. But that debate never took, in my view. I think that there's a lot more to talk about when it comes to that. But Snowden's had a big impact just in terms of public understanding of privacy and security. Just the fact that just about any web page you go to now has a little padlock in the top of your browser bar is a secure link. That was not true in 2013 when he made his revelations. It's because of Snowden, and in large part because of the NSA's break-in to the Google and Yahoo cloud infrastructure, that now most web pages on most websites are encrypted. So they are harder to intercept and more secure and safer for electronic commerce. That you can credit Snowden for.
And you can credit, too, I think, journalists like yourself and Laura and others for helping to make this debate public and understandable so that we could have. It's sort of a push and pull, a swinging back and forth of the pendulum, and maybe we're due for another pendulum swing. But before I let you go, I want to ask you just, what did Ed Snowden ever say to you about all your stories? Was he pleased? Was he gratified? Did he feel like you could have done more?
Snowden, I think, was fairly pleased with himself for the choices he made. He wanted multiple journalists to be involved. He thought we would do different kinds of things. He thought I would tend to do the sort of deeper technical stories and the stories that required sort of insight about intelligence operations on a global setting. He was going to get lots of advocacy and disclosures from Greenwald. He got a very fine film, Citizen Four, from Laura Poitras. And as far as he was concerned, this division of labor served the public interest, got the story out in a variety of places. He and I talked on a sort of technical level about most of my stories, and I tried to pick his brains, along with those of a number of other people, about what's the meaning of these documents. And he didn't always know. He's not an expert on every program at the NSA. He was a high-level system administrator, so he had access to large sweeps of the NSA digital systems. And he's an exceptionally smart human being, so he understood a lot of what he read, but he was not a substantive expert on a lot of this stuff. But we talked about the background of these stories, and he liked my approach.
Do you think Ed Snowden will ever come back to the United States?
Ever's a long time. It's not easy to see a way for him to come back voluntarily. There was some talk about a presidential pardon under Trump. That didn't happen. Even if he had been pardoned, I'm not sure he would come back to the United States. I think he would rather lay low in some Western European country and live a quieter life. I think he thinks he would be too much under a spotlight in the United States. He says himself that he'd be willing to come back if he could have what he regards as a fair trial. The Espionage Act, under which he's charged, has only two elements, really. The fact is that he had lawful access to these classified documents and gave them to somebody who was not. If those two things are true, and they are, then he's guilty. He's not allowed to offer a public interest defense, which is what he wants to do. He wants to say, it was in the public interest for me to do this. Here's why I did it. It was my purpose. You can see that some of these programs have been reformed because of my disclosure, and therefore it was justified. He can't argue that in a court of law, and so he won't voluntarily return.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for having this conversation with me, Bart. I enjoyed it.
Take care, Liz.
Please visit KentuckyAuthorForum.com for more information and for show notes on today's podcast. And please take a minute to rate and review Great Podversations in your podcast app. Great Podversations is distributed by Louisville Public Media. It's a production of the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. Mary Moss Greenbaum, producer, Evie Clare, associate producer, and Leslie Sissel, consultant. Great Podversations is supported by Bittner's, Brown-Forman Foundation, the Geans Foundation, James Graham Brown Foundation, and LDG Development. We hope you enjoyed this Great Podversation. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to your joining me for the next Great Podversation.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.